If you talk to any immigrant who came through Ellis Island in the late 19th century or early part of the 20th century, one thing that they will all have in common is a story about seeing the Statue of Liberty for the first time. When my grandmother came from Eastern Europe to the United States that way, she was 16 years old, and, you know, she was down in the bottom of the ship for most of the trip. But as they approached New York Harbor, they allowed everybody to come up on deck because they wanted to see this, at the time, relatively new thing. That was like 1905, 1906, and at that point, the Statue of Liberty was really only 20 years old, and people around the world had heard about it, but they hadn't seen about it because there weren't a lot of pictures going around the world, and certainly there wasn't video and certainly not live television feeds at the time. So being able to see it was, she told me, an incredibly impressive display, and it really made her excited about coming to America and starting the life that then led to my entire family. And my dad's family eventually came the same way. There's a new book about the Statue of Liberty written by my next guest, Elizabeth Mitchell. It's called Liberty's Torch, The Great Adventure to Build the Statue of Liberty. And this is part of the story that doesn't get told very often. You hear those immigrant stories like from my family and from many others that came through there, but you don't know much about how that actually became the Statue of Liberty. So I've invited Elizabeth to join me here today and talk about it. Welcome to the Big 550.
Thank you for having me.
I saw a headline today, in kind of a review of your book, and the headline was, The Statue of Liberty was basically the first Kickstarter project.
Oh, interesting. I haven't seen that one yet, but that is sort of true. I thought about that recently, that Kickstarter maybe have the same ideas that Bartholdi did, going out and trying to raise money penny by penny from individuals.
This was not, I think the popular belief is that the Statue of Liberty was a gift from the government of France. That's not true?
No, that's not true at all. I mean, that's actually what originally enticed me into the story, because I was at the New York Public Library Manuscript Division. I came across Bartholdi's diary from when he first came to America in 1871, and it was clear from that he was pitching the statue idea as a lone wolf. He didn't have the support of the government, and he only had a handful of people back in France who even knew he was coming to the United States to try and do this. So it really was his project.
Okay, so how did he raise the money?
Well, by hook and by crook. He basically, he started off trying to raise it on sort of, you know, patriotic grounds, both in France and in the U.S. In France, it was going to be this sign of what France had done to help America create a democracy. In America, it was going to be, you know, this kind of tribute to this, our greatest, goal and hope for the country. But he realized that people don't go for that, so he ended up putting on all these kinds of circus-like performances to raise money through ticket sales.
So I'm still stunned by the fact that this was really an individual project, but he had help from Americans, right?
Yeah, well, not when he originally started, his main help was from some intellectuals in France. There were some people who were really interested in creating a constitutional democracy in France, and that had been a hard fight. So they were behind him trying to do this. He had the idea for the Colossus originally for Egypt, and he actually went to Egypt and pitched it there. He brought a model and all the rest, and it was going to be for the mouth of the Suez Canal, and Egypt, the Egyptian Khedive, turned it down. And so he sat on the idea for a few years and then resuscitated it to bring it to America.
Was his original idea, the one for Egypt, going to be a huge statue?
Of a woman holding up a torch, yes. It was going to sit in the harbor.
Are you telling me the Statue of Liberty is an Egyptian leftover?
Well, sort of. I mean, let's keep it in perspective. I mean, the one thing is, it is absolutely a redesign of the design he had for Egypt.
Okay.
If you look at the image, it's the same image except that there's a different headdress and the figure's a little bit more, let's say, Roman, the one that we got. But it's the same idea. But he did, you know, when he pitched it to America, he didn't love the American people, but he did love the idea that we had created this constitutional democracy. And so on that level, it was for us.
What did he have against us?
He thought we ate bad food, we only cared about money, that we had some very mediocre, you know, buildings. But the things he liked about us were that he thought that our engineering was unbelievable, the bridges we had created, the cross-continental railroad. He loved certain individuals here, some politicians who he thought were incredibly courageous. But, yeah, he's kind of a funny figure because he's a little bit, like, you know, peevish. So it was sort of entertaining to listen to his take on America.
Okay, so he decides he's going to build this big statue for America and needs to raise the money. Mm-hmm. Tell me where Joseph Pulitzer comes into the story.
Well, Pulitzer was definitely the person who saved the day, really, for the whole thing, because over in France, they had managed to scrape together enough money through, you know, some straight donations, but mainly through entertainments like charging people to climb up into the head, because they constructed Liberty herself in a neighborhood in Paris, and for several years, you could go up into her head. They also put on a diorama, which was a thing you walk into and suddenly you think you're in New York Harbor, and that raised a lot of money for the statue. So anyhow, he had done that there, but in America, nobody had done anything to raise money for the pedestal or to put up the statue. So at one point, he has this massive 151-foot lady standing in a neighborhood in Paris, and meanwhile, back in New York, nothing has happened. So Pulitzer had a, you know, big beef with the rich, and he thought that this was one of these signs that the rich people were not giving money to this great cause, and so he called on the people. He had a newspaper, and he said, if you give even a penny, your name will go in the paper, and so people did that to see their name in the paper, and circulation went up, and the money was raised.
Pretty clever, Mr. Pulitzer. Yeah, not only was he raising money for that, but he was also selling more newspapers because people wanted to see their name in the paper. That's a pretty good idea right there. We should start a show like that on KTRS where you just read people's names.
You have to come up with a good cause. But you can
send us $10. We'll read your name on the air. All the cause will be we keep the money.
Yeah, no, I mean, also, Bartholdi was a genius in marketing. At one point, Bartholdi in 1878, before the statue had ever been made, he copyrighted the image because he knew people would want to use it in advertisements and all the rest. And he thought, well, if I could get a little bit of money each time it's used, then I will have made up some of the money I lost on even creating it. But unfortunately, it soon spiraled out of control. Everyone wanted to use the image, and he couldn't follow every copyright, so he lost out on that.
You mentioned making some money by selling the opportunity to climb up the inside of the statue and go up to Lady Liberty's head, which for a long time you could still do here in the United States. I know it was closed for a while. It may have reopened, but I know that when I was a kid, we went to Liberty Island, Bedloe's Island, and, you know, I was maybe 9, 8 years old. And when you're that age, the idea of going inside there seems like a fantastic idea. I just remember my parents, who were over 12, I think that's the limit of how old you can be and still enjoy this, they were just sweating and huffing and puffing, and I'm sure it's the same way. It's probably still not air-conditioned, and you go there on a hot summer day in New York Harbor, and it seems like a great, oh, we're going to climb to the top of the Statue of Liberty, but it is so anticlimactic. And by the way, St. Louisans can relate to this because we have the trams that go to the top of the arch, and every St. Louisan knows you do it once when you're a kid on a school trip, and then you never do it again because we understand the concept of being anticlimactic. Have you made that trip to the top of the Statue of Liberty?
I did when I was a child, too, and I remembered it as being, you know, hot, and also that there's that narrow staircase, and once you start going up, you can't, you have to come down the other one, so there's no turning around. But the thing is that, first of all, some people that I talked to recently out on the island, because you have to get a reservation months in advance, but people who had gone up did find it kind of great in his way, because it is still, you know, one of the better views in New York. But also, you have to keep it in context. When that opened, there no one had been higher in New York. There were no airplanes. There were no buildings taller than that. So that was really, to people then, like the biggest thrill you could possibly imagine. And there's great accounts of the people who first went up there and what they saw. So, it's you know, the whole the piece is amazing to me, because back then it was a thrill because of the engineer genius that went into it and all the rest. But then, you know, it's still an amazing logo for our country, basically. You know, it sends a message that it's a human face. We care about liberty. You know, I think it's quite tremendous what he did.
This is the Big 550 KTRS. I'm Paul Harris, talking with Elizabeth Mitchell about her new book, brand new this week, called Liberty's Torch, The Great Adventure to Build the Statue of Liberty, and the adventures of the sculptor Frederick Auguste Bartholdi, the Frenchman who built it and raised the money to bring it to the United States and put it up. How long did that whole process take?
Well, if you take it from when he first came to the U.S. to pitch his idea, and, you know, he pitched it cold. He talks about the funny reactions of people. That was 1871. It wasn't until 1886 that it was actually inaugurated.
Who was the model? There must have been a woman who had to stand somewhere in a robe and hold something aloft that he could say, okay, stay like that. I'm going to sculpt it just like you.
Well, there's some interesting stories around that because the body is definitely that of a woman, and people say that they think that the model was his wife. And actually, Bartholdi married his wife in the United States on a trip here in 1876, but she was a French woman. And the idea was that perhaps he had to do it here so he would be out from behind, from under the prying eyes of his mother, who was a very controlling woman, because if he was marrying a model, that would have been kind of not his, you know, what he was supposed to be doing. That ended up being an incredibly happy marriage. They loved each other to the end. The face, I have a controversial view on this. There's a story that goes around that it was Bartholdi's mother, but in fact, he never confirmed that. If you go back to the original records, there's not a moment where he says, yes, it was my mother, and he was such a good salesman, I think he would have said that. I actually looked at photographs, and he always put people he loved in his work, so it would be someone close to him. I looked back at photographs, and it really looks like a slightly feminized version of the face of his brother. Now, the thing is, his brother was a person who was his idol when he was a kid and had greater artistic talent and all the rest, but he went mad, and it was Bartholdi's job to go basically weekly to visit with the poor man in the sanitarium and just look at him and try and entertain him and all the rest. And I'm thinking that maybe he put the face of his brother on the work, but yet would not actually say that because it doesn't have quite the marketing.
No,
value.
Not quite the same for Lady Liberty. Yeah. Oh, she looks like my brother.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
If you look at it, it has a sort of troubled expression that was noted even at the time. And this photograph that I used as a reference definitely has that face.
And was the original green, or is that the years of weathering and salt air?
It was originally the color of a bright, shiny penny, and then it started to get a little darker as time went on. But as far as I can tell from the record, no one seemed to anticipate that it was going to turn this color of green, and yet they should have, because copper in these conditions gets a patina. The patina almost protects the metal, but it is the natural result of having copper out in weathered conditions. So it turns out to be a good thing too, because it ended up being easier to light once it had turned this color. That beforehand, the lights would just get absorbed by the darkness of the statue.
If somebody were to go to Liberty Island today, and even if they don't climb up inside, are they seeing 100% of what Bartholdi did, or has the Park Service or some other governmental agency had to repair it and replace parts of it?
They had to restore it in terms of, you know, protecting it against the weather conditions, getting rid of rust, doing some, you know, new attachments in there. But the design itself, all the metal of it is the original. And so it's really pretty extraordinary. I have to say, I went out there twice in the last couple of weeks, and it still is it's still quite magnificent. I mean, it's amazing, really.
And what about the Emma Lazarus poem that is on the Statue of Liberty? Give us your tired, your poor, your huddled masses.
That was actually written for a fundraising event towards the end of the time, right before the statue was unveiled. And it was part of this huge art exhibit in New York. That was a big deal because there was no Metropolitan Museum of Art or anything at that time. And so the person who organized it asked different writers to write something for a booklet that would be sold as well. And Mark Twain contributed a strange thing to it, and there were a bunch of other writers. But Emma Lazarus was a poet who had found some fame as a sort of political activist poet, and her friend asked her to write it. So at first, Emma Lazarus said, no way, you know, it seems like a, you know, sort of cheesy project. She didn't use those words, obviously. But she, she went away. But the friend said, what about if you think of the refugees from the Russian pogroms that you just met with? And she thought about that, came back with the poem. The poem was popular at first, but then it just disappeared from anybody's record. And it wasn't until 1903 that her friend made a plaque and had it put on the statue. And then it wasn't until the 1930s when a reporter noticed it that it actually started getting attention as being kind of the meaning behind the statue.
So the statue was there for 17 years of Bartholdi's original construction before the Emma Lazarus poem became part of it?
That's true.
And then a couple of decades before anybody noticed?
Yes. In fact, when Bartholdi was not exactly in love with the idea of it being attached to immigration, he at one point they thought that Bedloe Island, Liberty Island, could be used as a station for immigration processing, and he thought that would be a desecration and an abomination because he didn't want distraction from the statue. But in the account, when you were talking about what happened with your relatives, there's a beautiful moment that I came across when they inaugurate the statue, and the harbor's filled with boats, and there's, you know, explosions of, you know, rockets and everything else going off all over in celebration and high whistles. A boat comes into the harbor, and it's the very first boat of immigrants to see the statue, and everyone on the boat crowds to the rail to look at this liberty, and I find it very moving, you know. To see the first, to have a record of the first immigrants to ever see it and feel cheered by it.
Very, very moving. And I think still means something around the world. There have been duplicates, and I'm not talking about the one in Las Vegas, but I remember in Tiananmen Square.
Yeah.
Wasn't that part of the Chinese uprising that day,
definitely.
The Statue of Liberty?
If you think about it from the point of view of Bartholdi, the artist, too, what a satisfaction. He has this thing that's a shorthand for saying, we believe in freedom, and
right.
People can use it, and everyone understands that language.
The book is called Liberty's Torch, The Great Adventure to Build the Statue of Liberty. It's an amazing story and part of an American history that a lot of people don't know, and you really debunk a lot of things that people thought they knew about this, including me. And that's why I think it was such a worthwhile project for you. Congratulations, Elizabeth.
Well, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Elizabeth Mitchell, again, the book Liberty's Torch. I'm Paul Harris. This is the Big 550 KTRS.